How'd you like that new intro, ladies and gentlemen? We're back. We're the Podfather. I'm Jordan and I'm joined by
Alex.
And we're back officially. We had our little comeback special with Daniel, the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood episode.
Did you guys like that episode?
Please let us know. You know how to contact us, Facebook, Twitter.
Email thepodfatherpodcast@gmail.com.
I believe that's is that right? We'll edit it in post if it's wrong.
We're going to be back fortnightly.
A new fortnightly format. It should be a little easier for us to manage putting content out. If we are just doing it every 2 weeks, then we're probably less likely to slide into month-long, year-long gaps as we have. It's been about 3.5 years since we started the podcast. And we've got about half a year's worth of episodes, so we're going to try and fix that. We're very excited. We had a bit of feedback from the Welcome Back episode that we did. Alana Allen, who used to message in quite a bit in the old days, lives in New York now.
Oh.
Just moved recently, and she sent me a lovely message to say that hearing some familiar voices over there was quite a nice experience for her. So Alana, if you're listening to this one, we're thrilled that you're a listener. We hope you're doing kicking ass over in New York.
That's lovely.
At the Actors Studio as well with James Lipton. Yeah.
She's inside the Actors
She's
Studio.
Inside the Actors Studio.
My
yeah,
God.
I've got cool friends.
Okay, well listen, Alana, I hope you enjoy listening. We'll be in your ears fortnightly, like Jordan just said. If you can get us any hookups or contacts or interviews or sound bites from anyone in the Actors Studio, that would be fantastic. Just let us know.
Just let us know, Alana.
Just let us know. I'm not ashamed. I'll ask.
Yeah, you can do it.
just send me their email addresses and I'll just...
Mr. Dean Lipton. Dean James Lipton. Okay, and we've got some exciting news as well. Obviously, you heard it in the last episode. Arnott's Time is back as a staple. Now that we're in person, we can actually try biscuits again. But today, we're not going to try any biscuits.
Why is that, Jordan?
We're going to have a different taste experience. It's time to talk about cocktails. Yes, it's cocktail hour. Woo! So today's film, if you've read the title of the episode, is Tequila Sunrise.
Tequila Sunrise.
From 1988 and starring Mel Gibson, Kurt Russell and Michelle Pfeiffer. Tequila Sunrise... that's an interesting title. It's the name of a drink, a popular California drink. And we're about to try one. Do you want to explain the recipe, Alex?
Had you heard about the drink before the film?
I'd heard the name.
I think it's kind of one everyone knows.
I didn't know what was in it though.
Yeah. So you got screwdrivers, vodka orange juice, you got your old fashions, bit of whiskey and sugar syrup and Tequila Sunrise staple bar classic, I think. I don't think I've ever had one like this. So I think, you know, at home you just do tequila and orange juice, a bit of a budget Tequila Sunrise. Tequila Sunrise has tequila, orange juice and grenadine. Grenadine's like some kind of red syrup, some kind of sugary syrup thing. Cane sugar, cherry, pomegranate juice and cane sugar.
Oof.
I've got the bottle here, master of mixers. That's what gives it the sunrise look. So no one can see because we're in your... podcast apps, but maybe we'll take a few photos later on. We might get through a few of these drinks today.
Yeah, we're being a bit dangerous. Living on the edge. You don't get this kind of high from an Arnott's biscuit.
Have we ever recorded with alcohol before?
I certainly have.
Is that because you were already drunk when you came over? Or?
Look, I'd had a few drinks before recording a couple times, and then when you were in London, mate,
because of the time difference,
have a drink because I was recording at night.
All right, well, before we talk about the movie, let's talk about the drink. Could you please pass me one and then we'll have a little bit of a cheerio. I think they look pretty good, don't they? It looks like
and
a sunrise.
We're actually going to hear a real cheers noise today.
Whoa. All righty.
What do you think?
I think that's really bloody good.
Now... I was just saying, Alex, I don't drink a lot of tequila except like, let's do shots. But it's
I'm
nice
impressed.
With the orange juice. It's really sort of tempered the harshness of the tequila. And the grenadine, I think I might need another sip to fully appreciate that because it's...
That's a good sound effect.
It's right at the bottom of the glass.
Well, so for everyone listening, the grenadine sinks. So you've got your kind of tequila and your orange juice, which is a nice orange thing. You put in the grenadine and it looks like an orange to red sunrise or sunset.
Yeah, this is gorgeous.
It's really good. Now, we made them somewhat intentionally strong. So I was worried it was going to be really overpowered with tequila, but goddamn.
So, folks, thanks for another episode of The Podfather. We'll see you in a fortnight.
I was about to say, I just want to drink all night now. That's a good cocktail. Do we need to give it a score?
I think we absolutely have to. Yeah. That's it. I'll give it a 10. Tequila Sunrise has a Podfather score of 10. You could enjoy that with all sorts of films. Have you got the list there, Alex? What are our 10 out of 10 films? Is it just The Sting?
The only film with the 10 out of 10 is The Sting. So enjoy it with The Sting.
So far.
Tequila Sunrise, the film, could get a 10 out of 10. We don't know yet.
Or enjoy it with the film Tequila Sunrise, I think, too, thematically.
Despite the score of the film Tequila Sunrise, you should definitely drink a Tequila Sunrise while watching it. It might help you get through certain bits of it. And you might also...
Oh, I think I know what you think about this film.
Well, we'll see. You might also enjoy a Mint Slice, which actually has the score of 10.5.
Ah.
Or a TikTok. Or finally, a Shortbread Cream.
There you go.
So you've got everything there.
You got some
choices. I've taken your job today.
Yeah. Well, I don't have my laptop with me today.
So without any further ado, should we talk about the movie?
Let's just say I didn't love it. I enjoyed a lot of it and I was bored for a lot of it. That's sort of my general feeling for the movie. Like, it wasn't a long movie.
It wasn't that long.
It felt like a four-hour movie.
Probably longer than it should have been, yeah. It was just clocked in at about 2 hours.
The pacing was terrible. Mel Gibson. Oh, let's talk about the plot first, right? So Mel Gibson plays this sort of old crook. Not old, but he's trying to get out of the game.
Semi-retired drug dealer.
Yeah.
Put it that way.
It's a great way to put it. And he is friends, question mark, with Kurt Russell's character, who is a DEA agent. And then they both... Mel Gibson has a crush on a restaurant manager.
Restaurateur.
Called...
Joanne.
Joanne, what's her surname?
I think it's just Joanne.
Oh, she's got some sort of Italian surname because she runs this Italian restaurant. And she's played by Michelle Pfeiffer.
The IMDb just says Joanne. By Michelle Pfeiffer.
Well, you can tell that we really took in a lot of this movie because we can't even remember.
I think maybe her last
name
is the name of the restaurant. You know, before we continue, I think this film is a really good example of it's actually got a really cool cast. Mel Gibson, yeah. Michelle Pfeiffer, and Kurt
Russell.
And
in 1988, this was a huge cast. Like, yeah. Kurt Russell had already had, you know, his big role as Snake Plissken or whatever his name is from that one where he's got an eye patch and a snake tattoo. I can't remember. I'm
testing my knowledge now.
Yeah, this is going to kill me that I've
But it's post that. Mad Max. It's after Scarface.
It's after Lethal Weapon 1.
It's like, there you go.
It's so, before the anti-Jewish, hate videos.
Yeah, it's before some people's careers went down the gurgler.
Before Chicken Run. That's a good Mel Gibson film.
And I think it's a good example of a film that would have been huge at the time. I'm sure everyone saw it, but it's definitely not one that we know now.
And it did modestly at the box office. I'm going to spew a little fact at you.
Spew.
To come out of the gate. The first trailer for Tim Burton's 1989 classic film, Batman, was released alongside this film.
Right.
So a lot of people, according to legend of the day, would buy a ticket to Tequila Sunrise to go and see... Because this was the only way you could see trailers then.
Yeah.
To go and see the trailer for Batman.
Right.
And then they would just leave because they'd seen the trailer.
Do you think that's because... Okay, do you think the word got around at the time that maybe it was not the greatest movie? Or was it maybe just that the demographic who wanted to see Batman didn't give a shit about Tequila Sunrise?
Maybe a bit of both. Maybe a bit of both. But apparently the whole Batman mania... Because remember, this was the first Batman movie since the 60s.
It was the first real Batman movie because I guess there was the TV show and then they did a
spin-off movie. Yeah.
But I feel like I mean, that I've never seen it, but it seems
it's amazing.
Is it good? Is it like the show, though?
It's so campy. Pow, biff, bang.
Yeah, so that, you know.
Holy Polaris.
That stuff, what they were trying to do back then was make comics on TV, which I think is a really cool idea, and that's a, like, Batman's awesome. That old show and that probably that movie's awesome.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that, like, I think that that 89 Batman film was, like, the first Batman film, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely. And so that apparently contributed to its box office success. But I think, you know, I would have gone to see a movie that on paper looked pretty good if it's got Kurt Russell and Mel Gibson and Michelle Pfeiffer.
Well, especially at the time. And we literally just asked my dad about it and he seemed to remember it. Though it's not something that he has ever mentioned to me. It's not like,
a classic.
It's not one of his favorite films that he's ever told me about. So I think it was a film that came and went, like probably many of the films that you've seen in the cinema in the last 5 to 10 years that people won't be really talking about in 30 years' time until, you know, we're still doing the podcast and we go back through the archives and we say,
Alex, do you remember
when we saw that film in 2013? Rah!
Well, I'll tell you what. The only reason I ever heard about this movie is because we wanted to update our theme to something a bit more 80s. And we wanted something Miami Vice-ish. And I just looked up films like Miami Vice. And this came up. And I thought, oh, the poster looks cool.
It's got an amazing poster, which you also will sort of be seeing a bit of an inspiration for our artwork now.
Absolutely.
So we have definitely ripped off this film. And it hits a lot of the cliches of the 80s. But anyway, they're friends.
Yes, they're friends.
A little bit of a love triangle emerges.
Yes.
Kurt Russell's working for the police. He kind of doesn't really want to get Mel Gibson's character in trouble. McCusick.
Mac,
because they're old buddies. And that's kind of the premise of the film. And then it sort of goes on from there.
Does it, though?
Well,
no, that's the whole film. Oh, I want to catch you. Nah, don't. Oh, Michelle Pfeiffer's cute. Don't touch her. Nah, she can do what she wants, lol. That's the movie.
Was there a certain point where you sort of thought to yourself, is this a crime film or a romance?
Yeah. Well, I thought to myself, I'll tell you what, it felt like the sort of movie that you would just be flicking through the TV at 2 p.m. on a Sunday and it would be on and you would watch it because you might hear the music and think, oh, is this an episode of, you know, early MacGyver or something because of the saxophone? Or, you know, and you just watch it, but like it almost felt like it needed ad breaks. You know what I mean?
Well, so maybe it would have you know what? It was structured a bit like that. Maybe a bit like the old Miami Vice.
Like it felt like a telly show.
And because they did have a lot of amazingly cheesy saxophone music breaks.
Oh, but the saxophone was the best bit of the whole thing. Just, you're right, very cheesy, but also just. That brought the romance.
Yeah. It was really steamy at some moments.
It was really steamy. And when it was steamy, I was engaged. Like, this sounds very, you know, two-dimensional of me. But frankly, when it was sexy, and it was very sexy at times, I was into the film. And then for long stretches, it wasn't very sexy, even when it was trying to be. Mm. Mm. And I was like, well, what's the point of this movie then? They're just like, hey, don't, like that was the... Anyway, I didn't love it.
Well, my thoughts are I actually really do love a lot of this film.
Yeah.
Not because I think it's good, though. I love the cheesiness of it. I love the setting. I love, like, it's actually everything I wanted it to be. It just lacks, you know, some of the, I guess... real progression, story, and character development that, like, for instance, Scarface has. You know, it doesn't really have a lot of that. But I actually, and I we'll talk a bit more about it later, because there are actually some really cool plot devices that I think, I actually think that if this film was remade, maybe even now, it could be a really good movie. Because I think that it's got a good story. It's got a pretty classic, I mean, a lot of what the plot has is what we sort of look for in gangster films, like some good kind of like double crossing and surprise moments and really sort of cliche things. So it's got all of that, but it suffers from, I think, the time that it was made. more than anything. Yeah, watching it now. It hasn't dated well. Yeah. And even at the time, it probably would not. I mean, you could watch other movies from that era that were much better. That being said.
Yeah, if it was on TV, I would watch it. Like, no doubt about it. I would watch it if it came on. Like, it's not a bad movie, but it isn't a good movie.
What did you think at the beginning? Because I actually think that the opening scene was, like, pretty engaging. And I think it set it up for a possibly really great film. And one of the things that I liked a lot was that it starts while the credits are running.
Just the sound. So I love it when people do that because it actually makes you, as a viewer, really concentrate.
Yeah.
Because you're watching the like production company logos start or the credits start rolling, but you're listening to the dialogue and automatically you have to like up your engagement to figure out what's going on because the visual element's taken away.
Yeah, you have to imagine.
And it's like listening to a podcast.
Exactly.
And I loved that because I was engaged. I was because the movie forced me to really start paying attention from the get-go.
And it starts with Mac trying to help his friend do a drug deal. But he's kind of a bit cautious. He knows something's up. He goes and puts the cocaine in the toilet so that he can get rid of it quickly if he needs to. And a lot of that first scene was like really, again, classic tropes, gangster film, la la la. And then Kurt Russell's character walks in. What's his name, Nick? Frisia. What was his first name? See, IMDb doesn't have super Nick Frisia.
Super Frisch. His Super Frisch.
He comes in and there's this cool moment where they like look at each other. Actually, there's an amazing shot where the buyer walks in and then Kurt Russell appears behind. Did you notice that? You can't see Kurt Russell at all until the first guy walks off the screen and then he just appears. Like it was a really kind of
he'd been there
awesome little moment. Anyway, him and Mel kind of have a bit of an exchange and then they leave and you find out they know each other. So it's kind of got like it's a really cool premise I felt. Like I was really into that idea. Like they're old buddies and like, you know, throughout the film because of their relationship, you're not sure whether Nick, Kurt Russell, is like a good guy or a bad guy because he's working for the police trying to take down Carlos, a Mexican drug cartel guy. But Nick...
He's the one played by the Adams family. He plays...
Raul Julia.
Yes,
Julia.
Best known for playing the... What's the dad's name in the Adams family? Da-da-da-da-da.
Don't know.
Anyway.
That's where he's from.
Yeah, from the live action Adams family.
So you're not really sure whether Kurt Russell's character is good or bad, which was a fun bit of tension throughout the film, I think.
I think so. And whether you're supposed to like him or not as well. Because you're supposed to like him, obviously, because he's played by Kurt Russell. And then me, I'm looking at Mel Gibson's character and I don't like him because he's played by Mel Gibson. But at the time, he's still morally ambiguous.
Yes, and I think that actually, I think maybe both the characters have that same thing of like you've got a good guy who might have a bad side and then you've got a bad guy who seems to be doing the right thing. And
kind of like The Departed.
Well, a bit like The Departed and you know what? I got slight Heat vibes too because you've got the crime guy and the cop.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit like that too without the...
Being a good film.
Yeah. Without the expertness.
Having
of
said
Heat.
That, do you know this was nominated for an Academy Award?
For what?
Best acting.
For who?
Mel Gibson. No, not really. Best accent. No, it's funny because now if you listen to Mel Gibson as himself talking about, I don't know, how he hates the Jews or something, he's got an American accent because he's just been in that world for so long. But in this movie, you hear him slip into his Aussie accent. I love it when Aussies do that. We've talked about that a bit on this podcast.
I actually kind of liked his accent for that reason. Like there was a couple of words that he would say and he'd be like, oh,
G'day,
sounds
mate.
Familiar. Yeah.
However, no, Conrad Hall was the cinematographer and he, the director of photography, and he was nominated for Best Cinematography. He's been nominated for that award countless times, including... Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
No shit, we got to watch that.
And also Road to Perdition. Do you remember he won the Oscar for that?
No shit. Do you think that was maybe a long time coming?
I think he won a few times throughout his career, nominated a lot, won a lot as well, like 3 or 4 times, I think. So he was a cinematographer. When I found that out, I thought, okay, maybe this is a good movie. Well, this is quite an esteemed film.
I mean, that was one of my favorite parts about the film was the cinematography. Way it was shot. So like I said, there was that shot at the start. There was the fact that it opened with dialogue at the credits.
The steamy sex scene, literally steamy, like they're in a pool.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was shot beautifully, quite artistically. It wasn't sort of compromising to either of the parties involved, but you still got the sense you were watching something sexy. And it came in at the right time because the film wasn't very sexy anymore. Yeah, yeah, and then I was like, oh, okay, Conrad, you've shot this well.
And then there was that scene when Mac and Nick Frisher are on like the beach on the swings, and the sun is setting, and it absolutely looked beautiful.
It looked like our drink.
It looked exactly like our drink. So I think the aesthetics, the cinematography, it's all there, and the story is kind of there too, but the execution of this film, dated, didn't really land.
I tell you what, there's some weird subplots that are going
on
as well.
It's soapy, isn't it?
Like, very soapy. It just, like, it felt like a daytime TV show. Yeah. There were a few subplots that were a bit weird. Mel Gibson has some family issues. Like, he's got a son and an ex-wife, like, that really don't contribute anything to the film. The son does because he quite likes Quattro Formaggi, what's her name? Michelle Pfeiffer.
Quattro Formaggi.
Remember she says that at one point? Yeah, and that was the sexiest line in the whole movie. When if you hear Michelle Pfeiffer, just watch this movie to hear Michelle Pfeiffer say Quattro Formaggi. So there was that weird Mel Gibson family issue subplot. And then there was also Kurt Russell, his superiors. This actually could have been a really great part of the film and did add a bit of tension. His superiors are like, no, you have to catch this guy. But then at the end of the day, they're like, hey, buddies. And there's one scene where Kurt Russell goes into his boss's office and just like spills coffee all over him.
Yeah.
And it's so melodramatic. And then like 2 seconds later, he's like, they're in each other's office again. And they're like, yeah, sorry about that. No, it was my fault. Like,
and then there's like a scene later where they have like another little jokey. Yeah, yeah. I think that like there's actually a lot of the relationships have progressions in this movie. Like for instance, you know, Nick Frisher and Joanne, like, you know, they start an actual relationship and they, you know, they have sex. They sort of feel like they're in love for a moment. And then that flips to Mac and her. And then, like you said, there's the tension between Kurt Russell and his boss. And then that flips. And then there's the relationship between, well, Carlos.
Yeah,
and Mac. That one felt like it all made sense and it was kind of earned. But even then, like, he kind of turns on him a little bit in the end.
And I didn't understand none of it has the motivations of any of the characters.
Yeah, they didn't set
the... There was no stakes.
There was no stakes. And they didn't really explain why. It just all kind of happened.
Yeah.
And, like, it followed, like, a fairly... It all made sense, but they didn't earn a lot of those shifts or character moments.
Could you tell me who the director was? Robert Town. Robert Town, he wrote and directed it. He also, he's best known for writing the Roman Polanski film Chinatown, which I've actually never seen with Jack Nicholson.
We can do that one.
But that's like a even now, even with the way Polanski is perceived now, Chinatown is very well regarded. Particularly the script, he won an Academy Award for it, I believe. So
yeah, I've seen it. I'd like to watch it again, though.
He wrote and directed this. He also wrote a bunch of Tom Cruise films, including Mission Impossible 1 and 2 and one of the other ones that isn't a big one. But it just kind of feels... So when you know that the director wrote it, you sort of have to wonder, like, he was clearly quite passionate about this script.
He worked on Bonnie and Clyde.
And this... the old Redford one. Not Redford. Yeah, it is Redford. No. Who am I thinking of?
Warren Beatty.
Warren Beatty. Yeah. So you have to wonder, why was he passionate enough about this script that he had written that he wanted to direct it himself? Or maybe no one else wanted to direct it. It's hard to know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which kind of surprises me because, like I said, I really like the premise. And I think that it could – I mean, maybe at the time it was just maybe too much of the same thing because, yeah, it's a very cliched classic 80s type film with the whole cocaine thing and drug cartels. I mean, it's very of the time.
Yeah.
So maybe there was just too much of that happening and that's why no one wanted to do it. But honestly, if someone – I'm telling you, if someone remade it now and worked on some of the –
Who would you cast in the three main roles?
Jesus Christ. Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt and Margot Robbie.
Actually, no. Though.
I mean, like, that could work.
That would work a treat.
Nah, who would we do? I would cast Margot Robbie.
Yeah, as the Michelle Pfeiffer.
No
role.
Personal bias there, no crushes involved. I don't know about
what if you cast
we need someone like
Wyatt Russell, Kurt Russell's son.
That could be cool.
With Goldie Hawn.
That could be cool.
Wyatt Russell. He could take up the mantle.
The or maybe mantle. like a Matthew McConaughey.
In which role?
I think probably in the Nick Friche role.
Yeah.
And then you need who could do the Mel Gibson thing? People aren't really no one has that kind of like dad vibe these days, you know what I mean? Because he's kind of got that like
Steve Carell.
Steve Carell. Well, he's done some
imagine?
Dramatic roles lately, hasn't he?
Can you imagine Steve Carell?
Oh. Yeah, do Steve Carell.
Yeah,
there you
Steve
go.
Carell, Matthew McConaughey, and Margot Robbie. All right. Well, there we go. That's our dream casting. Before we stop talking about the writing, though, I want to talk about a few of standout lines that I bothered to write down. One of them was, let's not discuss his business or my business or your business, okay? Which felt like just a ripoff of, nobody talks about my business.
Yeah.
But
don't ask
that
me about
stuck,
my business.
Yeah, that stuck out to me. Also, I don't know what it is about going to high school with someone that automatically makes you friends for life, because that's their relationship.
And yep. Yep.
That stuck out to me for obvious reasons, to do with this podcast as well.
True. Very true.
We've known each other for 12 years now.
Over half our lives, basically.
Yeah. Pretty much half our lives. And there was another line that really stuck out to me. It was called no man should ever be blamed for what direction his dick goes.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Robert.
That doesn't really stand the test of time.
No. No, it certainly doesn't.
I think that we absolutely should be blamed for that.
Yeah. Mine leans a little to the left. I don't really want to be blamed for that, but I should be. It's all me.
Does...
Sorry to Mum and Dad if you're listening.
Does Joanne, does her character have anything other to do than just serve as the love triangle going from one guy to the other guy type damsel character?
Not on paper, but I think Michelle Pfeiffer is easily the best performance in the film.
Yep.
Whereas Kurt Russell was kind of cool because he's Kurt Russell, but it was a little stiff at times. And when he was emoting, it was not necessarily believable. Mel Gibson had some accent issues and was just kind of, hey, I'm Mel Gibson in a movie. Whereas Michelle Pfeiffer, like, it's a good performance. And you remember, like, she's a great actor.
She's a bit of an enigma.
And, you know, it was one of those performances that, like, in Scarface, which was her sort of probably her biggest role before this, she's just kind of playing sort of a coked out, sad, just the girlfriend character. Whereas this one, she was like a real person. You know what I mean? And I don't know if necessarily it seemed like that on paper, but it probably did because she gets to do some stuff like with the kid where she gets to be really caring and nurturing. She gets to, have this love triangle thing, sure, but she's also like a very successful businesswoman. She runs a cafe and she's very steadfast and sure about the way she wants to run that cafe, the restaurant.
Yeah, I agree.
So I think yeah, easily the best performance in the character in the film, and not a bad character for Michelle to sink her teeth into.
Yeah, no, well, exactly, and it's almost weird because like she does, it is a strong character with all the things that you mentioned. It's almost a shame that all that she serves is to kind of go back and forth between the guys. And I mean, I don't think she speaks to another lady in the whole film.
Is there another lady?
There's
the ex-wife, right? Does she show up at one point?
I don't think she's in it.
Or she's just on the phone?
I think she's maybe on the phone, yeah.
She's the Maris of the... I got it in, baby. I'm trying to think. Well, if there were, they weren't real characters. Or we would remember them, surely. Yeah. So she did a good job, and it would have been a good part for her at that time. And then a few years later, she would be in the sequel to Batman herself.
Who does she play in that?
Catwoman.
No shit.
Have you seen Batman Returns?
Yeah, very, very long time ago.
It's one of my favorite Batman films.
I should rewatch them.
Even to this day.
That's the one with the Penguin.
Yeah, Danny DeVito. Yeah.
Right. What else has Michelle Pfeiffer done?
Lots of things. She was in a Scorsese film, I believe. She's sort of done a lot. Recently, she's been in Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Was she in Ant-Man and the Wasp?
Yeah. Just in a small part. Her career is one of those ones that it's kind of stood the test of time. She doesn't have, besides Catwoman, there's no like iconic role. She's just a movie star. Do you know what I mean? In the same way that I think Brad Pitt is a movie star. People go and see a Brad Pitt movie. And he doesn't have a franchise behind him except maybe the Oceans. Whereas someone like Downey Jr., who's Iron Man, and his movies have made the most ever at a box office. I think Sam Jackson actually has that title. But no one goes and sees a Robert Downey Jr. movie when he's not playing Iron Man.
Yeah, yeah.
Michelle Pfeiffer has the sort of career where people like just respect her as an actor, but like she was a movie star, and now she's highly regarded as an actor. And I think that's pretty cool. Yeah, I think I'd like to go back and watch more of her films.
I would too, because it was like she's a great actress.
Yeah.
Awesome in this film, awesome in Scarface. And I just realized that I haven't really seen much of her, but I know her.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, she's one of those people that, like, yeah.
Michelle Pfeiffer, that white gold. Yeah.
And I obviously have seen Batman Returns, but long time.
Now, I have a question. It's a very important question. Why is it called To Kill a Sunrise? It's one of those films where
I actually think it's a pretty shit name for a film.
Yeah.
And I think that Mel Gibson, he orders tequila sunrises every time he's drinking, basically.
Does he?
Didn't you notice that?
I didn't notice.
No, so he's always drinking them.
Oh, well, that's why it's called that then. Okay, that's great.
Did you not notice that?
I didn't care about this movie. I didn't notice that he ordered a tequila sunrise once. Well, I didn't hear it uttered once, so I was so confused.
Well, he doesn't say it. He just gets them from the bar.
Oh, like, and you saw the drink and you know
it was orange and red. So he's drinking them.
Okay.
Usually at the restaurant, I think. He's drinking them. Then there was a bunch of awesome sunrise shots sunset shots. Mexicans, tequila.
Oh, yeah.
I mean...
Oh, and then what was the tagline of the movie? A dangerous mix.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So maybe they're, you know, you've got...
They're a cocktail themselves. You've got,
yeah, Michelle Pfeiffer's the tequila, Kurt Russell's the grenadine, and then Mel's the orange juice. The boring...
But not the orange juice, because he hates those.
Jesus. So, yeah, I don't think it's a good name for the film, though.
No.
I think it's a stupid, cliched, excessive 80s name.
But it got us drinking for this podcast.
It got us drinking for the podcast. It fits the bill.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, it's an awkward name, I think.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really describe anything that happens.
No.
Which might be a testament to the fact that, you know, the same guy wrote and directed it, and he obviously had this little bit of a pipe dream thing, and he was like, I just want to have a cool sunrise shot or sunset shot.
But that was kind of the 80s entertainment world for you. Let's just have a cool moment, you know. And there is a boat that blows up and that's the poster shot, you know what I mean? That it all felt like it was designed so it would make a cool poster.
Well, yeah, and that's what I mean. Like, I think it was, again, just one of those, like, big films at the time. And I always, when I'm watching something like this, I mean, I'm trying to see it through the lens of that time, like what it would have been mm-hmm. like seeing it then. And then I'm also trying to think, like, you know, what are the movies that are coming out now that are like that? You know, there are so many films that come and go every year that you might hear about. So I really want to see that. You never end up seeing it. I mean, those are probably the Tequila Sunrises. You know what I mean? Like, there's other things like that. They still get made. Maybe they're better now, or maybe they'll be as dated now in 20 years' time.
Or maybe they'll find an audience. Like, sometimes movies like that get an audience and they become like cult classics.
Yes.
Whereas Tequila Sunrise doesn't have that.
It feels like it could, you know what though? It feels like it could have. It was close to being a cult classic. And I want to ask you, one of the reasons why we do this podcast, is this a gangster film that you should see before you die?
No. No. It's not a... It's like you said, it's kind of barely a crime film. Although it is, obviously, because there's busts and there's actual criminal activity going on, particularly towards the end.
It really is just like a long episode of Miami Vice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how it feels. And for better or ill, that's what the movie is. Maybe see it if you really like Kurt Russell or you really like Michelle Pfeiffer or you really like Mel Gibson. But they've all got better movies. And I guess, would I see it? Am I glad I saw it before I died? No. No. I don't feel any way or another about it. I'm glad I tried the drink before I died. I'll order these again.
A few more of those.
There was something I really liked about the movie while we're talking about it. Oh, wait. Do you think you should see it before you die?
I think it's probably a deep cut for me, like in the sense that there are things about it that it appeals to a lot of things that I'm into because I kind of like looking at these time capsules of excessive weird things from different eras. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, this is so 80s. Like, I like that. And evidenced by, I think a lot of people, and this is a whole other conversation, but like, you know, we're living in a time where people are reviving or regurgitating culture a lot. You know, you see people walking around like they're Gwen Stefani from No Doubt, or you see people walking around like they're a Nike commercial from 1992 or earlier, you know, 80s Reeboks, all that kind of stuff. It's all really popular now and people choose different things. But what I'm always conscious of is that, like, people, when they regurgitate culture, I don't think that they get it right. They pick three different things and combine them in a way that people wouldn't have done in that time.
No, like, it's a dangerous mix.
It's a dangerous mix. Like, people weren't wearing those shoes, those pants and those jackets in the 80s. No. You've just taken three amazing examples and put them all together, which is fine and, like, it's cool and people can have fun. But I like looking back to real examples of those times and, like, finding where people find the cliches and finding what people take from it and understanding it more in what it really was like.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, like Stranger Things. Like, I haven't watched a lot of Stranger Things, but it feels very, you know, like it's trying to be of the time. And at the same time, I think they do a pretty good job, but at the same time, sometimes you're just like, oh, that seems a little bit like put together to make it seem very culture-y, you know?
Yeah. So like, let's make it feel like a... like Minotaur, the store.
Yeah,
you know what
exactly.
I mean? Let's make
exactly.
it feel like, you know, like it is a pop culture website. Like,
yes.
It you know,
yes.
Let's make it feel like BuzzFeed will write a list about it in a month.
Which, at the end of the day, you know, again, it's fun, but it's not authentic. Whereas Tequila Sunrise is probably a very authentic experience of, you know, a 1988 film and time and, like, or at least what people aspired to be like in the time. So for that reason, I really enjoyed it and the aesthetics. And that's maybe one reason why you should watch it if you're into this sort of idea. But you can get basically everything in this film from other movies.
Yeah.
So it's a deep cut.
It's the first film we've seen, I believe, in this list that has Crowded House in the soundtrack. Did you notice that?
No.
There's a recurring dream, the Crowded House song.
Wow. Plays.
And I wasn't expecting it at all. Maybe I should have been because...
So was that the only song?
There was also Don't Worry Baby by the Beach Boys. There was a cover version of that at some point. And that's a good song. And that felt very beachy. It was the Crowded House that got to me. Because that song feels sort of quite California-y.
Yeah,
And then when Neil Finn starts singing, I was like, oh, wow, yeah, this is Recurring Dream. Like, it just sort of fit the vibe of the movie in a really unexpected way. And whereas a lot of the film was just a sort of generic 80s sort of synthy score and then the sax solos we were talking about. I think there were a few other songs sort of either playing in the background or you know, less obviously, but that one was one of the sort of mid-movie driving montage.
I tried to find the soundtrack today on Apple Music and it wasn't there. I might try and source it otherwise because I wanted to kind of listen back to some of it.
Yeah, I found the soundtrack.
On YouTube maybe?
The track listing online, but I couldn't find it to listen to it. So that was one of my favorite parts of the movie actually. I was like, oh, g'day Neil. Nice to hear from you.
I mean, that, you know, again, like, you know, imagine being Crowded House back then and saying, oh, we want your song for the new Kurt Russell, Mel Gibson and Michelle Pfeiffer film. I mean, you'd be like, that would be sick. Yeah, let's put it in. And then like everyone just goes to watch the Batman trailer and they don't hear the song.
Oopsie. Was there anything else very pressing? Have we spoken for very long today?
We're coming in hot around 42 minutes.
Oh, well, this is kind of perfect because we've been trying to – we did put you through a two-hour episode last time.
Yes, we're not going to be doing.
We're going to try to be a little more succinct, and we're going to cut down a lot of the preamble stuff that we used to do. Let us know what you think about that.
The only thing that I think we've missed is just the Carlos/Escalante storyline.
The actual crime bit.
Yeah, the actual crime bit. Yeah. Although, like, you know, it all kind of happens. It's kind of a side to the romance, which is kind of funny because, you know, is this a crime film? Is this a romance? I don't know. It's definitely not a rom-com, although it could be funny.
This would play so much better if there was comedic elements.
Yeah,
it would. Steve Carell will do so good with this material.
Basically, there's, you know, the climax of the film is that the LA police link in with what they believe to be the Mexican police. But in an amazing twist of events, which was, it was pretty good, it turns out to just be Carlos who they were going for. Yeah. Did you see it coming?
I didn't see it coming because I didn't give a shit.
Yeah, I know. It was a bit kind of just like, oh.
Oh, cool. Yeah, of course that's happening. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there was no weight to any of it really, was there?
No, yeah, he double-crossed him and then he double-crossed him again and pulled a gun on him and then was like, nah, you can live and then you can die. No, that was the vibe that I was getting.
And it wasn't, there was no, yeah, again.
And then don't kill the lady. Oh, you know, you can. No.
Yeah, yeah.
I will. No, I won't then.
And, you know, none of it was earned in the same way that, like, a lot of that's, you know, the stuff in The Departed towards the end where that all, people double-cross and things are surprising.
Yeah, and the love triangle as well in that film was much more... had much more weight to it.
Yeah. Well, that's it.
That's it. Shall we give it a score?
Yeah, let's give it a score.
I am going to give it a 5. Maybe I was thinking less originally.
I was going to give it a 5 as well.
Well, let's just give it
a 5.
I think
it's smack in the middle.
And that puts it pretty low on our list. It puts it above King of New York, which has 4.25, and below Bob LaFlambeur and New Jack City, which both have 5.5.
I would much rather watch Bob LaFlambeur again. Probably would rather watch this than... Was King of New York the Christopher Walken one?
Yeah.
That was weird. That aged less good than this film. So... You know, I think it's probably about right. What do you reckon?
I think we've put it, right we've put it far enough down the list that I'm quite happy with that.
The closest film that I could compare this to that we have watched, what comes to mind is The Hit, because that's a British film, but it's also very, very 80s.
Yeah, in a lot of the same ways. Something that no one had remembered.
Yes, and but I actually would like to watch that again, and I think it could get a better score because, like, I have fond memories of that film now, The Hit. Yeah. Even though, like, yeah, it's a bit of a B movie. Yeah. But like, I
and
like
there's
it.
A Hawthorne game in the middle
yeah.
of it.
Yeah, there's a Hawthorne game.
Yeah, watch The Hit, ladies
watch
and
the
gents.
Hit. I know you came here to listen to Tequila Sunrise, but if you haven't watched The Hit, go and watch The Hit with Tim Roth and John Hurt. Music by Eric Clapton. Set in mostly in Italy. There's some great driving. There's a Hawthorne game. And then listen to our episode about it.
Yes, please.
Or do that first. Whatever floats your boat.
Whatever floats it.
All right. Well, thanks for listening.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
It's good to be back. Share the podcast if you listen to it, please. We know that there's quite a few people downloading it, but we don't hear from you. So if you do listen to the podcast, let us know on Facebook, Twitter, or email. Share the podcast. Leave a review on iTunes.
Yes.
That always helps.
Because the last few episodes that we've done, or the last few times we've sort of rebooted, it's been, you know, a bit more tentative. But we're for real this time. We're back, and we're back for good.
Back and we're here to stay.
So please start engaging again, because that's one of our favorite parts of doing this, actually, is hearing from people we know and also people that we've never met in our lives. And actually, we went to the Astor a few months ago now when they were doing their Tarantino movies.
Yes.
And actually, one of our listeners got in touch with us to see if we were going to be there one night, and we actually weren't that week. We'd been the week before. But even just knowing that there's people out there that are interested in similar things, and the engagement that we get from you guys is one of the joys of doing this.
Yeah,
outside 100%. Of just talking to each other in a room about movies, which we would do anyway. So yeah, please hit us up. And it's great to be back.
See you next time. You know, what makes something like, well, I'll cut that out.